This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the year-over-year change in the U.S. CPI exceed 2.7% in April of 2025? At Interactive Brokers, the yes forecast contract was recently priced at 23% and the no was at 75%. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on future events like climate change and the economy and even politics. You choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Interactive Brokers forecast contracts are commission-free, and you earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors, but the best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction. Go to IBKR/forecast and start predicting today.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Tariff turmoil, it's not getting much better. Stock market chaos, uncertainty reigns, and they're ringing the recession alarm. Is this a ticking time bomb? Our guest today, Brian Dress from Left Brain Research. All this and much more on episode number 917 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to another action-packed episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. I am in the hot seat. I am in the studio at Horowitz & Company. We're downtown Fort Lauderdale with the lovely weather that we've been having. But yeah, we're in the studio right now where we do this episode each and every week of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as, well, we have the DH Unplugged, where I talk with John C. Dvorak each and every week, and we go through some of the fun things that are going on in the markets and have a good time doing it as well. Plus, when I have those interviews and those things that I do for other either podcast or shows, well, we have it all set up right here. Working on a good amount of research right now, trying to make heads or tails of what is exactly happening, probably no different than any of you, trying to understand the implications, the potential outlook, the volatility, what does it mean, the opportunities, all that gets blended up into a nice sauce to try to figure out exactly what we're going to do. Now, a lot of times, I got to tell you, one of the hardest things to do is nothing. Sitting on your hands, just being patient. It's very difficult, especially when you're looking at some of the areas of trading that we have to do and the kinds of investments that we have, because you want to look at the longer term, the outlook beyond what is happening right now. And one of the challenges that we have and that you have in investing is that sometimes there's a lack of clarity. And that lack of clarity creates uncertainty. That uncertainty creates market volatility, and that becomes an emotional nightmare. I mean, it becomes a situation where we all get tense. Now, some will act out a little bit differently, and you'll go and you'll make moves that someday you may regret. Sometimes you do things that you may be happy about. Those may be either buys or sells, or sometimes it's even sitting around doing nothing. The longer this kind of volatility and uncertainty goes on, the more emotional people will get, and it will end one day with a big kaboom. But let's talk about what's going on right now. This tariff turmoil, right? The U.S. government has announced all these tariffs and rolled them back, but not on China, where we saw 125% duties on American goods being kicked back to us, and the Dow Jones Industrials went berserk and it came back when we saw there was going to be potentially a 90-day rollback and all the things that we know that happened over the last couple of weeks. And then we saw on the weekend, last weekend, the not the last couple of days, but the weekend before, right? Where we came into the office Monday and we said, wow, hey, good news. The exemptions were going on for certain chips and for smartphones and certain computers. Cool. Everybody got really excited. Then we got a bombshell again by NVIDIA. That was due to the a rule that was actually pre-Trump, where there was certain chips that were not allowed to be sold or limited supply allowed to be sold to China and other countries, this H2O, plus other companies got stuck with the same situation. NVIDIA is taking a, what is it? I think a $5.5 billion charge. AMD's getting hit. A few other companies. And then we have the uncertainty that we've been talking about and what's going on there. So you put a underlying base of uncertainty, concern, inability to see the future, and degrading market conditions as well as concerning economic conditions. Not terrible. I mean, we saw the Philly Fed this week came in at negative 24. That's something I look at. But our jobs numbers didn't seem to really be a problem. Inflation was actually coming back down a little bit, or at least stabilizing, not getting crazy, not going in any direction fast. That was good. Or that is good, I should say. Yes. Yes. I'll give you the fact that we're seeing a little bit of a jump in inflation, and that's a problem. But generally speaking, the problem that you have is that no one really knows what's going to happen after the initial sting of the tariffs and people doing front running and buying, and if that's going to push up prices more than and then come down, or if we still haven't seen at all the consistency of what is going to be. Now, you'll hear a lot about this one-time price increase from the tariffs, this idea that we don't have to worry about the consistent and constant and never-ending increasing in prices because tariffs are a one-time shot. Okay. But they may be a one-time shot that is like 2 years worth rolled up into one. Where you have a 10% increase in a price. Well, I mean, can you imagine if somebody said that the inflation this year is 10%? People would freak out. And that's what they're doing by bringing a lot in and buying a lot ahead of what their perception is of any of these tariffs going in. And that's what happened. Now, whether this is a game or not that the administration is playing just to try to stoke the demand, I'm not buying that. I think that's a dangerous play, but okay. Right now, the big issue is that we're seeing these signals about recession. Consumer sentiment plunged 11%, marking its fourth straight monthly decline. You saw that, was it JP Morgan said now that we have a 50-50 chance of recession. BlackRock said that the U.S. economy may already be in one. And maybe this is what's giving a little bit of firepower to President Trump to put poor old Powell in his crosshairs. Now that the markets are getting whacked, I mean, Trump wants rates down. Now, rates usually go down in a economic situation that is very poor. Now, of course, the Fed can come in and they could, in fact, say, you know what, with all the things that are going on with the markets, this is going to possibly end up in a recession. And as such, we're going to try to get ahead of it. The problem is that we also have the same circumstance going on with inflation that is causing them to pause, saying that they're concerned about the tariffs. They're concerned about the pricing that's going to happen from this. And how in their right minds could they go out and actually reduce rates, causing even more inflation? But yet, President Trump, who now is calling names at Powell, too late Powell, that's his new word, especially after Thursday's ECB rate cut. In fact, he said, I quote, the ECB is expecting to cut interest rates for the seventh time. They did do this. And yet too late Jerome Powell of the Fed, who is always too late and wrong, too late should have lowered interest rates like the ECB long ago. But he should certainly lower them now. Powell's termination cannot come fast enough. Wow. That's pretty strong. All of a sudden, we're trying to deflect. Now, I thought that Navarro, Peter Navarro was going to be the one that was going to be deflected and possibly even fired. I'm still going to stick with that. That the that he came in too strong and with some boneheaded calculations of what the tariffs charged in the United States was when they included the currency manipulation, the trade barriers, that whole weird calculation they came up with other countries was charging, and why Trump actually came in and said, you know what, let's hold off for 90 days so we can get our facts straight. Powell's now the one. Powell, Jay Powell, federal chair. Now, later in the day on Thursday and into Friday, there was a lot of walking back going on. Senior White House officials told the press that President Trump's Truth Social post should not be considered a threat to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell. So that very strongly worded commentary on, because that's how we all get our information, right? From social media. That's the politically correct way of doing things, to get just to spout off whatever we want. And then that's how we get it, as opposed to a news conference or a planned event. Yeah, just whatever I feel like saying, what I was going to say. That's how we make policy, through True Social and Twitter. Earnings. Talk about that. Now, here's a bright spot to a degree. Things actually financially look not so bad. In fact, I'll go along with saying that the banks came in with some really good numbers. The problem they had, though, was that the outlook was souring, dim, lots of concern, changes in outlook, and even some of them pulling their guidance. That was a big problem. And that is because that they're sitting, these CEOs of financial institutions making the big bucks who have been around all this are no different than you or me. And the reason I say that is that their outlook is clouded. Now, I have some definitive thoughts of how we should be invested for our clients right now. And tracking back to similar circumstances from an economic standpoint, as well as if we look back to the first Trump term and some other terms of other presidents where there was a lot of controversy, I have we put down a pretty good roadmap on where we want to be and some of the changes that we will make if this or that happens. So we have a plan. Got to have a plan. Our clients know the plan. They're well aware, they're well informed, and the portfolios are set right now for that. We're not frozen and we're not stubborn. We're going to make adjustments like you should be, being flexible and being able to go. We talked about this a few episodes ago, right? Where I compared the idea of Nirvana and Buddhist philosophy and Hindu philosophy with the idea of patience and being able to make those changes when they are appropriate. So there's a lot happening from a guidance standpoint, but yet a lot of uncertainty. So don't feel bad that you have less clarity than you maybe think you should, but because these guys that are running the money around the world are in the same boat. We did see some reports from home builders. Not great. Misses by retail. And only a few are out at this point. You know, earnings season just started. We saw that bombshell last week from United Healthcare. No, oh, that was rough. There's a miss and outlook. I mean, it killed the whole sector. Really a problem with the cost factors related to Medicare and their outlook. In fact, when I woke up on, it was Thursday. When I woke up on Thursday morning, I remember seeing that United Healthcare was down 135 points. Now, there's a multiplication factor of how much each point is worth if you're, in fact, a member of the Dow. And if you take that, it's about seven, round number seven. Seven times 135, that's like 800 points or so on the Dow. That was just taken off to begin with by United Healthcare. One company, because it's a high-priced company, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is a price-weighted index. It's pretty crazy. I don't think a lot of this is going to change, and we have to be, I think, very well aware that we are mired in this kind of situation for a while to come. But why not ask our guest? It's going to be Brian Dress. He's an investment advisor for Left Brain. He also holds a position of director of research. He works with high net worth investors and families on tax efficient investments and planning strategies to help them achieve their financial goals and dreams. And before, when he began his investing career in 05, he joined Left Brain in 18. He earned a bachelor's degree in Georgetown, became a CFA in 2021. So let's get right to him. So Brian, hey man, how you doing?
Doing well. Great to be back with you, Andrew.
Thanks. I mean, there is a lot of things that have happened from the last time that we talked. And I think I could say that if we didn't talk for 10 years, the last several months was still more things that happened than the last 10 years in terms of just lunacy. So there's a lot of things happening. You have the opportunity to look at all this, do some research, invest in it, et cetera. One of the things that I think I want to start with you is you look around and you see what's happening. How does that change what you do from a research perspective?
It doesn't really change a ton about in terms of our research. You know, we're still micro-oriented. We're still looking at what individual businesses are doing. But, you know, here we are talking in early in 2025, and we're just kind of waiting for the next quarterly earnings. I guess we're getting that soon. And we want to see what the CEOs and the other officers of these companies have to say in terms of how current events are impacting their business. Because, you know, we can sort of guess at, you know, a lot of the macro factors that are out there, but until we hear how it filters down into the individual businesses, it's really difficult to draw any really strong conclusions.
So what's really kind of fascinating is that I would say I did a show this week with John C. Dvorak, DH Unplugged, and we talked about the earnings that came in from Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Citi, BlackRock, and all that. Pretty much what I saw, and this is consistent with other companies too, was, you know, we had a good quarter, but damn if we could tell you what's going to happen moving outwardly.
Exactly. That's exactly what we expected to see. And over the next few weeks, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of pulling of guidance. And you can take that for what it is, but that's challenging from a research perspective and from an investment perspective.
Yeah, because now all of a sudden, the opportunity to say, okay, well, they made X and now they think they're going to make X minus or X plus or come in, you know, the same is a problem because you have nothing to base that on, right?
Yeah, we're sort of guessing, and it's all kind of based on, you know, obviously what's going on with tariffs and a lot of other things in Washington. And things are changing, not just weekly, daily, but hourly. It's pretty difficult to draw conclusions that are going to make much sense, you know, in a few weeks from now or a few months from now.
So we have a new thing that we do. If you want to try to do this at your office, it'd be interesting. So during the day now in our office, we have a drinking game that every time the word tariff is utilized inside of one of our streaming news items, we take a shot.
So have you had anybody carried out on a stretcher yet?
Yeah, we haven't worked for weeks. And then, but we did have somebody actually have to get their stomach pump when we had the drinking game that was about, that started with Trump did this or Trump did that. That was, we had to get charcoal pumps of a stomach for that one.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. The news flow right now is such that it's very difficult because even in a mist of calmness, you get some crazy headline bomb that throws everything into a tizzy.
So I guess my perspective on that, I guess coming into the year, what I was telling clients was we're going to try to filter out the noise and just focus on what's happening, what actual actions are being taken. But the problem is the noise is the noise becoming signal. So it's difficult, again, to sort of filter through what really matters.
Yeah, because when you have a situation where, you know, during the morning, a president says it's a good time to buy, and then all of a sudden in the afternoon comes out and limits and pauses tariffs for 90 days. I mean, was that actually two different unique circumstances and commentaries, or were they both aligned? And is that something that's planned to be utilized similarly in the future? In other words, is there a method to the madness? Is there a plan? I'm not asking you to answer this. It's more rhetorical. You know, it's something that's, I think, difficult for all of us. Now,
yes.
One of the other things we've seen, aside from the volatility, the uncertainty, the mess that's being caused right now, which, by the way, I think you would agree with, is where the problems come in with guidance, right? Because people, CEOs, CFOs, they don't know what they're going to be spending money on or what income they'll be receiving, revenue they'll be receiving. They don't know what their margins are going to be from a profitability standpoint, and they really have very low vision. It's almost like, you know, driving down a road. You could do 90 or 100 if it's a pure, beautiful day out there. And even if it's raining out there, you know, okay, it's raining, it'll stop eventually, I'll use the windshield wipers, et cetera. But, you know, when you get into a situation where it's pea soup and you can't see right in front of you, very difficult to make any kind of forward progress.
Yeah, I can't disagree with any of that.
And that's kind of how I see it right now. We're mired in a fog bank.
Yeah, there's some similarities to COVID, but there's some differences, obviously. So in COVID, we had tons of uncertainty. But the Fed was more in play in terms of helping. And also, that wasn't really, well, I guess some people think it was, but it wasn't really a man-made situation. And so I was trying to go back through economic history and try to discern, are there any times that there were these sort of, was there really a man-made recession at any point in time? And the only thing that I could come up with was kind of early 80s when they were trying to tamp down inflation. So there was a reason to it. But this one's, you've probably heard the word unprecedented. That's another drinking game you could play. I think we are in sort of unprecedented times here.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've noticed over the last several weeks is that obviously we know that stocks are being affected dramatically. In 2002, if we hearken back to that, in 2002, there were some problems. One of the big problems was that zero, nothing, nada, nothing worked unless you owned energy shares, if you remember that whole thing.
Sure.
But basically, an asset allocation process was just obliterated. Bonds got just trounced. You could not even play the VIX because the VIX was relatively low because volatility, it wasn't there. It was just this constant and regular slide, and just things got worse and worse.
Right.
Now, bonds got kicked in the teeth over the last few weeks. They went from 3.7% on the 10-year to 4.5%. The dollar is hitting multi-year lows against a lot of currencies out there. Tell me about your thoughts on that and where do we go with this? Because, you know, just earlier this week, the Fed and Powell were talking about how they kind of also don't have any visibility and they're not exactly sure what they could be doing, but they're thinking that they don't have as much scope as they thought they would have because of all this tariff nonsense. So let me take a drink again. There we go. But fixed income, let's talk about fixed income. Then I want to talk about, I know there's a lot there. Then I want to talk about, okay, well, what do we do maybe to give us kind of like a fixed income style without being in fixed income? So first, fixed income, what's going on?
Okay, so interest rates, forecasting interest rates. Well, if Jerome Powell doesn't have a good sense of where it's going, then I'm going to just tell you I don't. Because he's the one in charge of that rudder. So we're out of the forecasting interest rate business. We're always out of the forecasting interest rate business, but this is definitely a time when we have to remind ourselves that that's not what we do. But what I do notice, we do a lot in high yield. For those of you who've listened to me on this show before, or Nolan Langford, we do pick through the high yield bond space, picking individual bonds, and we're starting to see some things that are becoming interesting. So for the last, you know, like you said, in 2022, we saw some really interesting opportunities and rates started to come down over the last, you know, the 2 years, I guess two and some years since. We weren't as excited about those opportunities, but some of the bonds that we followed over many years are starting to creep into that 7% and 8% range again. And that's getting, that's interesting to us again. So individual bonds are looking interesting. What's going to happen with the 10-year? I couldn't tell you, Andrew.
So what's interesting about that? Because now we're starting to see that credit spreads are starting to widen again. And are you concerned about if we do, in fact, get into a recessionary period that some of these corporates are going to be problematic?
Yes and no, I guess I would say. So a lot of these companies are really well capitalized coming out of COVID. So, you know, a lot of these companies, if you remember back to COVID, when we went back down to the zero interest rate bound, a lot of companies went out and took advantage of that and issued quite a bit of debt at that time. So that was what, 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those were 7, 10, 15, or 20-year bonds. And so capitalization remains reasonably good, even in high yield land. Obviously, if there are companies that have maturities coming up, meaning if they have bonds that are maturing soon, that may be more of an issue. And that's why we select individual bonds. We don't buy a whole, you know, we don't buy bond funds. But there are individual situations where companies remain well capitalized. Maybe they pay a dividend. So there's an option where they could stop paying the dividend and, you know, continue servicing the debt, things along those lines. That's the way we kind of look at things. Are there levers to pull? We do think there are definitely opportunities in household names out there that are interesting.
You know, household names as in staples in the household names, or household names as in things we just know about?
Things you know about.
Right. But the problem is that things we know about, we find that things change. Look at what happened last Wednesday, Tuesday night, as a matter of fact, last week, where our household name of NVIDIA was starting to get better and there was exclusions and exemptions. Then all of a sudden they come out, Jensen Huang comes out with a bombshell of, you know, the H2O chip, the H20 or H2O chip, whatever they call it, is going to be kind of strapped down, and they're going to take a, for whatever reason, they're taking a $5.5 billion charge, which I thought was really weird, which is why probably the market punished them that day. But, you know, you have things like that, because this is not just a CEO coming out and saying, hey, you know, we see what's going on, and we see a little bit of slowdown in the buying of this. That's not what's happening. This is all policy being imposed on these companies. And it's either policy that was historic and renewed and revived or not changed, or something brand new out of absolutely nowhere that they get slammed with. So how do we deal with that? I mean, I honestly know we keep coming back to the same point here. How is investors and investment advisors, listeners out there, deal with this kind of inability to understand what the rules are?
It's hard, obviously. We're looking at situations like NVIDIA. We still love NVIDIA. We did some trimming of NVIDIA because we had gained so much on it. So in terms of being prudent in the situation that we find ourselves in, I think it did make sense to pare back a little bit of that exposure. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're looking down the road, 3, 5, 10, and 20 years down the road, and what's going on from sort of the artificial intelligence AI perspective is a train that's not going to be stopped by anything. And so those are the type of businesses that we want to continue to own. It doesn't really, I mean, I know tariffs in the short term are probably going to have some impact on earnings from quarter to quarter, but at the same time, you know, we have a lot of trust in what they're doing at NVIDIA and what's going on in a broader context with AI. And we're going to have to stay the course there. That's just the way it's going to be. Will we have to take some heat on it? Maybe. But we have to be comfortable in owning things that we think have a chance to continue to perform despite the tariffs. You know, we think companies that have superstar CEOs like Jensen Huang are going to find a way to make chicken salad out of chicken, you know what?
Yeah, so this is like what Apple did last week or so. They airlifted like $2 billion worth of iPhones
yeah,
out of India and brought him to the U.S.
Right. I mean, capitalist is intelligent. CEOs are smart. You know, capital is going to move where it needs to move to get the best return. And yeah, I think there are some reasons to be pessimistic, but also, you know, things always do move forward, and we're going to get through this one way or the other.
So let's talk a little bit about alternatives to things like fixed income. I use the word alternatives. That's going to be used a lot here on this discussion, I think, because there are all these other investments that are outside the genre of stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities, cash. There's other things these days.
Right.
Talk me through some of the things that you've been looking at and utilizing.
Well, for us, we don't play the game of alternatives. I mean, you go to any place where advisors are gathered or asset managers are gathered, it's certainly on the tip of everyone's tongue about doing something with alternatives. Well, maybe that made sense, you know, 15 years ago, but now it's become extremely crowded trade in my mind. Private credit is one of these things that we've heard a ton about the last few years. Like I said, Andrew, we like to pick individual bonds, and there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is transparency. So, you know, companies that have private ownership aren't compelled to release their financials to investors. Or maybe there are some ways to do it, but it's not publicly available data. And so it's difficult to assess whether a company's creditworthy when you don't have that transparency. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we like the public markets. But the other problem with private credit is, you know, a lot of these portfolio companies that are in private credit are smaller. And, you know, most of the stuff that we do, Andrew, is companies that have enterprise value of at a minimum $5 billion, but usually over 20. And, you know, for the market historians out there, companies that are small. So if we look at, say, like Russell companies, even, so that's like $2 billion and smaller, they tend to be really economically sensitive. So if we're moving into sort of a downturn economically, these companies could be adversely affected by a downturn. Now, the companies that are portfolio companies for private credit may even be smaller than what you see in the Russell 2000. And so I think it's really a huge risk to be holding a lot of this private credit because of that reason alone. And then you add into that mix also the fact that you have illiquidity. You know, you should be getting a premium for liquidity for not having liquidity. And we're worried that that's going to be actually the opposite going forward.
Yeah. Hang on a second. I want to take a quick break, but I want to continue on with this discussion with Brian Dress on private credit for a second, because I have a few examples I'd like to bring forward of things that I'm seeing and some things I'm seeing, right? Some examples and things I'm hearing and seeing in that world. Hang on a second. So let's talk about Interactive Brokers, because you should know this by now, but if you don't, you do know that at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you can trade over 10,000 U.S. stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index futures and options, U.S. Treasury bonds, and more. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low transparent commissions. Open an IBKR Brokers account today. Go do it. And I want you to discover more trading opportunities at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. So we left off on the discussion of private credit. And let me give you a couple of anecdotal items. I got a call from somebody who works for a very large, very, very large private equity firm, we'll call it, and telling me that they're doing markdowns of about 25% of the real estate positions in their portfolio. It's a very difficult time. And this is a very well-known, very well-known, very large, very big company. This is not slouchy. Matter of fact, if I told you the name, you'd know it. And they're taking big markdowns on that. you know, you look at the private credit side of things, and you mentioned earlier about the size issue. You know, some of these things are dealing with $5 and $10 billion. And those companies, by the way, may have billions and billions of dollars worth of debt that is laddered at all sorts of ranges, right? You know, a two-year, sure. 1 year, 30-day overnight lending, whatever, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The small guys, the private credit, they're going after companies that are like, hey, it doesn't have to be this small, but it could be someone who's looking for, you know, $500,000 that, you know, is looking for $1 million, $5 million. Now that may seem like a lot of money to some, but it's really not. And the problem is they're looking probably to only one place. They're getting it at a higher level than usual. So maybe if current rate is 5%, you know, they're paying maybe 7 as a number. Okay. Mm-hmm. The thing is, the private credit equity companies will maybe also take a piece of their company for something like that, right? But right. more so, that amount of money is not liquid. And you mentioned this before, but let me explain how not liquid it is. And you could help me after I mention this.
Sure.
It's probably their main piece of debt that's outstanding. And now they have this inability to pay it back because when things slow down, this is probably a large component of their overall expenses. The debt service becomes a big part of their expenses, and they don't have many levers to pull in order to pay that off.
Right.
And then they give a piece of equity away, and now the private credit turns into a vampire monster, by the way, looking to seize control and do all sorts of other things. And it becomes this not only illiquid situation, but a very difficult situation for the actual investor that has no say in anything that's going on, just sitting there twiddling their thumbs. Moreover, last point, you're probably not going to know the valuation change forever because they're not really required to do a true mark to market because this private credit, how are you marking to market an $800,000 loan to mom and pop on the corner? Now, not all private credit has to be that small. It could be gigantic also, right?
Sure.
But tell me where I'm missing something there.
I don't think you're missing anything. I'm always reminded of, I don't know if you've heard this, but Warren Buffett used to say about the stock market, you know, his frustration about the stock market was, you know, that there's a price called every day on any given stock and it doesn't really have any impact on the business. And what his analogy was, he said, you know, imagine if your house was, if there was a price called on your house every day, you know, how that would really impact things. This is kind of the reverse of that, right? So there's no transparency on the pricing in private equity or private credit. And so you don't know what you don't know until maybe it's too late in terms of, you know, what's going on in the business, in the portfolio companies, and the marks to market. There's no transparency there. So that's why we kind of shy away from all that. And again, like the example that you kind of mentioned about companies that are smaller and maybe have less access to capital, that's kind of why we like to be in the public markets where we can look and see what's the history. When was the last time they did a debt transaction or some sort of exchange? You know,
and if paid, I could go and back and paid it off successfully.
Yeah. So if I can go back and say this company issued debt 2 years ago at 7%. That gives me some information in terms of what, you know, banks and other underwriters think in terms of their creditworthiness. Whereas again, in the public markets, if I look at a company that had to do a senior debt transaction at 11 or 12%, that again tells me and gives me information. Well, they're not really that creditworthy and we're probably going to steer clear from that. So the transparency is really important from our perspective. And you add in the liquidity as well. I really think it makes a lot more sense to be invested in public markets. Now, understanding we may be a little bit of a unicorn in terms of choosing our own individual securities, but I do think it's a better mousetrap.
Well, and it gives you a lot more flexibility. It gives you a lot more ability to understand the underlying and not just follow, you know, listen, it could be a positive and a negative, right? Because something happens sure. in one of the securities you picked versus a full diversification in just the index, there may be more exposure and more downside.
That's right. But if we can find a way to on balance, you know, get a little bit more yield on our overall portfolio, then we can withstand one or two of those every 5 years. And not only that, we're watching these situations. So usually when you see a bankruptcy in a public company, it's a slow motion car crash. So like, for instance, Bed Bath & Beyond went bankrupt. I don't know exactly if it was 2022 or 2023, but you could tell that company was distressed for 4 or 5 years before that. So what we like about these situations is that, again, you have transparency and information and financials, so you can see if something's deteriorating and then maybe sell at a loss, but not at zero.
Yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to private markets, and it comes to private markets then maturing and going public, what is the story with the IPO market, and why has it been so blah over the last couple of years?
You know, it's been interesting because, you know, of course, people are probably talking their book, but we've been waiting for years now for the IPO market to unfreeze. It's been many years since we've seen a number of IPOs coming in one after the other. And for private equity, that's crucial. They need an exit. So private equity, just to give you a little background, they buy companies that are maybe distressed or undervalued, and they do whatever their magic is. And then out the end, they find an exit, whether it be selling the business or taking it into the public markets. So if we have a situation where the IPO market is more or less frozen, or, you know, one or two trickles out every few months, it makes it really hard for these companies to find exits for their portfolio companies. Now, I did a little research today, and I guess the private equity market was about $600 billion in 2000. And in 2024, it's about $8
trillion. Wow.
So
what happened?
A lot of people really sold the idea of private equity to a lot of asset allocators, which is fine. But what my point would be is that it's a pretty crowded trade. And so there are a lot of really affluent people out there who are involved with private equity, and a lot of endowment funds and pension funds and what have you. I think there's a lot of risk in that. And in terms of if you have new money to deploy, I think it's really risky to put a little bit more on this huge pile of this $8 trillion pile that's out there, where there's no clear exit strategy for recognizing a profit.
And then the other problem you have with private equity / private credit is that the structure of it is usually 2 and 20, expensive as an investor. And capital calls.
So capital calls. I think this is something that probably people, I'm sure there are professional allocators who think about this, but there are also run-of-the-mill, you know, affluent, high net worth and ultra high net worth people who buy into these private equity funds, and they don't realize that they may get a call at some point saying, we're going to need you to send in another $500K here, pretty quickly, because we have whatever issue we've got inside the fund, we need more capital. That can't be very, a very pleasant call to receive as an investor.
Well, some of them are planned. Some of them we know that
you
buy into $500,000 into private equity that does, llama farms in New Mexico. And you know that you're going to give them $10,000 with a commitment over a number of years for $400,000. You're going to get calls. Hey, you know what? We found something we want to do, and so you have to have the cash flow to keep that going. There's some interesting thoughts behind that, but you also have to have the ability to withstand a very long time without getting your money back. That's where the liquidity problem comes in. I'm a big fan of liquidity. Big fan. As a matter of fact, detest illiquidity. And I do understand there are things like your home and other private equity deals. And obviously, you know, you want to be in the market for a long period of time, but that doesn't mean you have to be illiquid. Hating illiquidity doesn't mean I have to trade out of something every day.
Not at all. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned what you did, but because, you know, our clientele, a lot of people own a lot of real estate. And so, like you mentioned, there's a lot of illiquidity in that. So why add more fuel to the fire from an illiquidity perspective?
Right. It's like having a lot of really great stuff in the refrigerator, but you got it locked and you can't open it. How do you eat? all right. In terms of...
Llama farming sounds pretty good, actually, now that... Yeah. In times like this.
Yeah. Let's kind of segue into a thing that you've been talking about for a while, things that we've talked about together and that you've written about, and that is the continuation of AI and cybersecurity. And, you know, we saw a crazy move. I don't think there's anything else that can be said about it, but a crazy move. With the whole AI move, and everybody was all ecstatic and freaked out and all the money spent. I saw some... And originally, back in the beginning, I saw some problems with it, that companies like Microsoft was, you know, giving money out to all these different AI companies or companies that were on the brink of something or somewhat, but also saying to them, hey, by the way, we're going to give you $3 million, but you got to commit to a $2 million contract to use our Azure. And that was pushing money back at Microsoft taking money off of their balance sheets, putting it into their income statement, essentially, by routing it through a third party. Make sense?
I don't have an opinion on that particularly, but...
But if that happened, it was a brilliant little charade.
Sure, sure.
And there was a lot of that going on.
Yes. I think, again, we try to look further down the horizon, so 5-10 years, and it's pretty hard to argue the idea that artificial intelligence is going to disrupt not just tech, but any number of businesses, because... Obviously, understanding the capitalist system, what we're trying to do is increase margins any way we can. And especially in the U.S., labor costs are really expensive. And also, there are a lot of tasks that, you know, machines are going to do better than humans. And we can empower humans to do what they're good at, which is, you know, relationship building, creativity, and things like that, that AI hasn't really... found a way to disrupt yet.
The potential for bringing a lot of manufacturing back to the United States is probably going to end up being done by a machine to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, that's been said explicitly by some people in the administration. So I guess I'm going to take them at their word on that. I think it sort of defeats kind of the purpose of what they're trying to do.
That's the point I'm making. That's exactly the point I'm making.
But that being said, leaving the political discussion aside, I do think AI, it's inevitable that AI is going to find its way into a number of different verticals, number of different industries and sectors. And we're just kind of getting started. We're still in the early innings of it. And so whatever's happening with, you know, tariffs, macro economy in the short term, I don't think is going to disrupt what's happening, you know, in the long term for this.
Where do you see the greatest opportunities? Is it in the actual AI companies? Is it in the hyperscalers? Is it in the alternative energies? What are some thoughts?
I still think it's a lot in the semiconductors. So NVIDIA, of course, Broadcom, and then TSM is going to get a piece of whomever is the winner in terms of semiconductor design. So that's Taiwan Semiconductor. Mm-hmm. We like those three the most. I think it still remains to be seen who's going to be the winners beyond that. I think software has been sort of beaten down over the last few years, and I don't have a name for you, but I do think that's an area where we could see, you know, a lot of development and a lot of additional margin based on, you know, AI getting into the coding space. So it remains to be seen who the winners will be of that. But I think you've got to keep your eye on and listen to what these CEOs are saying in all manner of businesses and see who's got the most penetration of AI. And whoever does is going to be a winner, because we're pretty sure AI spend is going to result in margins.
Who's your favorite company besides NVIDIA in this genre of technology?
In technology, I've always loved CrowdStrike.
Really? Even with all the problems, yeah. Huh?
I love the way they handled the problems.
Yeah. Are there still lawsuits pending, though?
Yes, but so my understanding and what I've heard and read is that CrowdStrike had its issues last summer in 2024, especially with the airlines having issues with the system. But it wasn't a breach. It was some issues that had to do with an update of the software.
Technical blooper.
Yes. So my understanding is that CrowdStrike, George Kurtz, the CEO, and the sales team went out aggressively to all their customers and told them what exactly they were going to do to solve the problem and how they're going to handle the crisis and how they're going to make everyone, can't say whole, but try to solve things for people and how it's not going to happen again. And then you also look at how the stock performed. Obviously the stock was hammered, I don't know, about 40% right away after the situation, but then made a new high after that. So I kind of looked at it in a different way than a lot of people did on level one, which was obviously level one says, this is a real huge problem for CrowdStrike. My takeaway was how ubiquitous and important CrowdStrike is in so many different businesses. That was my takeaway from the situation. And again, the way that they responded to it, I thought was really top notch. So, and then beyond that, cybersecurity is a crucial spend. It's crucial that you spend on cybersecurity if you're in the enterprise. You can't choose not to. And then let's weave AI into this situation. AI means that the threats are going to get more sophisticated and more acute. So from a total addressable market standpoint, we expect that to continue to increase for CrowdStrike. So we like CrowdStrike, and I'll throw you one more name in cybersecurity. That's Zscaler. With Zero Trust is the architecture behind that. Zscaler is a company that helps people log into connecting users directly to applications and not networks. So it reduces the threats to networks directly. So we think there's a place for a number of different winners in cybersecurity, but we think cybersecurity is going to continue to grow in terms of a total addressable market. And that's what we want to see when we're looking for investments.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Brian Dress, Left Brain Research. We'll have all the information on how to find you, how to click you, how to get information about you over on the show notes for episode number 917 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me as always. Great having the opportunity to speak with you and flush through this. You're very calm and cool and collected. I liked it.
I don't know if I'd feel so calm inside, but I'm glad that it's coming out that way. And I would definitely encourage everyone to go and see our YouTube channel. We are up every few weeks with our thoughts, not only on the markets, but also on some personal finance topics as well.
Good stuff. We'll make sure to get you there. Thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks, Andrew. Right, great to be with you again.
Thanks. And that is a wrap of show episode number 917. On our way to 1,000 episodes, all the way from 2007 to 2025. So I got to figure out exactly when we're going to target 83 more shows. So that would be about what, a year and a half? So that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of about summertime-ish 2027. That'll be our 20-year anniversary. We got to do something special for that. We have some great guests coming up, by the way. Pat O'Hare is going to be coming up. I'm very excited about this. He's with Briefing. We got a tax dude, Dan Pilla, coming up. We have Dan Figella coming up, which is great. He's awesome. Ed Easterling. Who else do we have? Let me see. Just a second here, because I want to see what's happening in May. If I can find it. I guess I can't find it. May, we have Tom Nelson, Barry Ritholtz, And we have, Frank Curzio in June, and just a whole host of great people that will be on the show coming up. So make sure to stay tuned. Also stay subscribed. Go over to Apple or Amazon or YouTube, or we just started YouTube. We don't have many people watching or listening to us on YouTube because it's just audio. Spotify, that's a big one. Yeah, I love Spotify. Go over there also and make sure to subscribe. Say some good things about us. And of course, if you want to get in touch, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me this week. I'll see you again next week. We got lots to talk about. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.